This is Gulf Coast State College, Anatomy and Physiology, Fluid, Electrolyte, and Acid-Base Balance, Part 1. The first thing I want to say on this slide is, since we're talking chemistry, a lot of students at this point in time will kind of want to shut down and get a mental block, but let's not do that. I'm going to try to make this easier than it really is. So here we go. First, let's start by defining body fluid. What is body fluid? Body fluid is water and its dissolved substances. We'll talk about what those dissolved substances are on the next slide. But the main thing is, of course, that water is the single largest component of the body and can range anywhere from 45 to 75% of the body weight. That's not a number I want you to remember. I'm not big on numbers because numbers have a tendency to go in one ear and out the other unless we use them often. So if I want you to know a number throughout this course, I will tell you, you need to know that number. So that's just an interesting range. Also, an interesting number is that infants may have 75% or more water. And it's been said that premature babies, they are actually made of approximately 90% water. But what should we know? We should know that body fluids in an average lean adult human being make up 55 to 60% of the body's weight. You can see that off to the bar graph shown here in a light purple off to your left. It just so turns out that males have a little bit more body water than females. There's a reason for that, and the reason is, in general, women are genetically predetermined to have a little bit more fat, mostly subcutaneous fat. And the way I like to get students to try to remember this is, do oil and water, do fat and water mix? Well, if you've ever looked at a bottle of salad dressing, you know they don't mix. So the more fat we have, the less water we have, because they don't like to go together. So that's one way to remember that females are 55% water and males are 60% water, because females have a little bit more fat. But a lot of students don't like that example, so I'll give another one. How about this? How about we think of men as just being all washed up? And maybe that's another memorization tool you can use to recall that men tend to have a little bit more body water than women do. Also, along the same line of thinking, the amount of body water with age tends to decrease, because in general we tend to gain a little fat as we get older, maybe get that spare tire thing going on. And again, since fat and water don't mix, as we get older we have less percent of our body made up of water as we age. Okay, so on the last slide we said body fluid is water and the dissolved junk that's in the water. What is the dissolved junk? These dissolved substances, more technically termed solutes, are mostly electrolytes. Remember from A&P1, electrolytes by definition are inorganic compounds that break up in solution into charged particles that you all remember are called ions. The most common example and most important example in the human body is salt. And when you dissolve salt in water, it breaks up into charged ions, a positive sodium and a negative chloride. Okay, so far we defined what body fluid is. Now we have to talk about where body fluid is. So we're going to use these bar graphs off to your left and break it down using this figure. First, the major body fluid compartment is intracellular fluid, typically abbreviated ICF. It is exactly where it says it is. It is fluid inside the body cells, and it makes up about two-thirds of the total amount of fluid in the body. That just makes sense to me when I'm memorizing this stuff. I'm thinking, well, I'm mostly made of cells, and most of my water, therefore, must be in my cells, and that just makes sense to me. The second major compartment is called the extracellular fluid compartment, typically abbreviated ECF. This is fluid which is located outside the body cells. This makes up about one-third of the total body fluid volume. For your studying pleasure, however, the extracellular fluid compartment has been further broken down into two more compartments. So you need to know that 80% of the extracellular fluid is interstitial fluid. Remember, that's the fluid in between cells. And again, that makes sense to me. Number one, we talked about, well, I'm mostly made of cells, so most of my water is inside my cells. And then it helps me to remember the second most common place we have water is bathing those cells in the interstitial space. The second subdivision of the extracellular fluid compartment is the plasma, and 20% of our ECF is located in the plasma. So we have to memorize that breakdown. And some of you are thinking while you're making notes, well, hey, Dr. Gonshore, you're forgetting lots of stuff. I mean, there's fluid we learned that makes up our lymph. It's around our brain. It's in our joints. It's inside our eyeballs. It's around our lungs and around our hearts. But the good news for us is all those other places you could possibly think of, we're just going to lump all them as a whole into the extracellular fluid compartment. I want to stop here while you're making notes and talk about a clinical aside here that's just for you. Some of you may be wanting to go into pediatrics, and those of you wanting to do that, goodness be with you, because pretty much everything you learn when you study adults, physiology and diagnosis and treatment and management, you have to learn a whole new thing for kids. Kids are all different. The drugs are going to be different. The dosages are going to be different. And speaking of body fluids, everything we just talked about was with an adult. In a child, it's all reversed. The percentages, the locations that we talked about in the fluid compartments are really flip-flopped in a child. So what you need to know is that if we lose about 20% of our cardiovascular volume, we'll be in shock. And that's not good, because you're probably one step away from checking out. Remember, in an average adult, we have about 5 liters in our cardiovascular system. So that would mean if we lost about 1 liter, we'd be in shock and maybe on death's door. What about in an infant, though? On the bottom of the slide, I put something down there. It says an infant blood volume is about 80 milliliters per kilogram. What does that mean in English? In English, that means a 10-pound baby to be in that same serious situation as the adult would only have to lose about 6 tablespoons of blood. So please keep in mind how infants are so different than adults when it comes to these fluid balance issues. And when you're in triage and you see that little baby come in and it looks like maybe a little bit of blood, that actually might be quite serious. Okay, so we talked about what body fluid and where body fluid is. Now let's talk about how that fluid shifts between compartments, because due to age or due to drugs or disease or dietary changes, fluid will shift between compartments. And I want to start off by looking down here to the right where I put a big red box around this figure from your book, because this is really a good summary of what we just did. All I said in plain terms so far was that, number one, fluid is located mostly inside of our cells. Number two, place where fluid is located is in between our cells. And the third fluid compartment is the plasma within our blood vessels. So, if we look at this figure very closely, there's only two places where fluid can shift between compartments. Number one, only the blood capillary walls are thin enough to allow exchange of fluid between the plasma and the interstitial fluid compartments. Number two, the cell membranes are the barrier which separate the interstitial fluid compartment and the intracellular fluid compartment. And how will fluid shift between those three compartments? Remember osmosis from AMP1, please. The key point here, which will get you through most of this section of the course, is water follows the salt. In this PowerPoint, you could think of salt like a sponge. If you dump a salt shaker in a puddle of water, won't it suck up a lot of that water? Well, sure it will. So please remember, water will seek out and follow the salt. Okay, now we need to talk about how the body gains water and how the body loses water. In your figure to the left, there's a bar graph in blue that shows water gain and a bar graph in orange that shows water loss. I don't want you to remember the individual numbers. I just want you to know the main ways in order how your body gains or loses water. Let's start with water gain. And you know this without even looking at the slide. I mean, how do you get most water into your body? Well, most of it you drink. So the number one way you get water in your body is you drink it. The number two way you should be able to tell me that you get water in your body is you eat it. Yeah, because there's water inside of our foods. The third way we get water in the body is called metabolic water, formed during, all of our favorites from AMP1, aerobic cellular respiration. Anybody want to go over that again? I know I don't. But here's the deal. Remember when you studied that whole thing? At the very end of that electron transport chain, you were sort of passing around that hot potato, high energy hydrogen, and something had to accept it at the very end of the line. And if you remember, it was oxygen. Oxygen accepted that hydrogen, and it formed good old H2O, or water. So that's the third way your body gains water. What about water loss? Again, without even looking at the bar graph, I bet you could tell me the number one way water gets out of your body. And the number one way it gets out is through the kidneys. Yeah, we urinate it out. That's the number one way to get water out of your body. Second way is we sweat it out through our skin. Don't believe me? Well, wait till you see your triathletes who, exercise vigorously for long periods of time. They can get dehydrated just by losing a lot of water through the skin. You remember the skin is the largest organ in the human body, And we can lose a lot of water through that high surface area organ we know as the skin. Number three way we lose water out of our body is we breathe it out through our lungs. Don't believe me? Well, on a cold day, go ahead and get next to a window and breathe on the window. And what will you see? Like a mist, like a fog. Because there's water vapor when we breathe out through our lungs. Again, that's how long-distance runners can become dehydrated. By sweating it out and breathing out the water, they can become dehydrated. I mean, certainly they're not stopping along the road to urinate, but they still can become dehydrated. Fourth way you'll be able to tell me that we lose water is we do lose a little bit of water in our feces. The one number I do want you to know is this. In an average human being, for the purposes of our course, let's say the amount of water that we take in during the day or gain during the day is 2 liters. That's about 2 quarts. And the amount we lose is also 2 liters or about 2 quarts. So for our course, 2 liters in, 2 liters out. Why? Because the body likes to be in balance. You remember from AMP1, the term for that you should all write down is homeostasis. Let me give you a good example you're going to encounter on the floors if you're going into healthcare. You're going to be asked to measure something called the I's and the O's. We just call that the ins and the outs, or more technically, the intake of fluid and the output of fluid. And as a nurse, you're going to be asked to measure how much they drink, how much they eat, how much they urinate, how many bowel movements they have during the day, and you're going to record it in the chart. And some of you are going to think it's not important. And on a typical day, 2 people call in sick, 2 are on vacation, 1 is out on a break. And so you're maybe going kind of fast and you say to yourself, well, this is not important for me to measure all this stuff. I got more important things to do. I'm passing out pills and I'm putting in IVs and looking at EKGs. So I'm just going to fudge that number. And I'm just going to make it up because I don't have time for this. And let's say you write down on Mr. Jones's chart that he had 1 liter in and 2 liters out. Go ahead and write that down somewhere on your paper as you're taking notes. 1 liter in, 2 liters out. And then what happens is the doctor looks at your nursing note and says, oh my goodness, 1 liter in, 2 liters out. Mr. Jones, he's going to become what? He's going to become dehydrated. So based on your fudged information, the doctor writes an order. He puts an order for an IV, runs IV fluid in at a certain rate to try to get the patient back in balance. And then, let's say you come in the next day, Mr. Jones all hooked up to an IV, and you look at Mr. Jones, and he looks all puffed up like the Michelin Tire Man or the Pillsbury Doughboy. Why? Because he got massively fluid overloaded because he really didn't need that IV fluid. And you can really harm the patient that way. You can throw them into congestive heart failure as an example. So let's talk more about homeostasis. Let's talk more about being in balance. First, let's talk about fluid balance. And I've asked students to define fluid balance on the test before. Fluid balance is where the amount of water and electrolytes gained equals the amount lost. And you should all circle or highlight and the correct amounts are in the correct places. So using our same example, maybe you drew a picture. Here you come and see Mr. Jones. Now he's puffed up like the Michelin tire man with edema. And now you say, uh-oh, wow, I guess it really is important that I do to measure the ins and outs, right? So today you measure them correctly, and you measure 2 liters in and 2 liters out. So, I'm going to ask you, is Mr. Jones puffed up? Mr. Jones, is he in fluid balance now that you got 2 liters in and 2 liters out and he's looking like the Pillsbury Doughboy? And you're thinking to yourself, well, the amount in equals the amount out, but what's the problem? The correct amounts are in the correct places. He's puffed up like the Pillsbury Doughboy. So if you keep 2 liters in, 2 liters out, he's going to be not in balance because the correct amounts are not in the correct places. If the other day when he was normal, you had 2 liters in and 2 liters going out, really, yeah, then he'd be in fluid balance. Okay, what about acid-base balance that we'll talk about in detail in part two of this series? Acid-base balance, by definition, means the amount of acid, typically abbreviated as hydrogen plus, gained equals the amount lost, and, circle the and again, and the correct amounts are in the correct places. While you're making notes on this slide, I want to use an example that your book actually uses. It's an example of enemas and fluid balance. I don't know if you know what an enema is, but they still use them in the hospitals and nursing homes, typically for elderly patients who have constipation. And what they do is have a big red rubber bag with a hose hooked up to it, and they put a certain amount of fluid in the bag, and they run that fluid into the rectum, and they let it sit there for a certain amount of time. And here's the deal. If you put the wrong amount of fluid in, the wrong balance of fluid and electrolytes in the bag, if you let it sit in there for the wrong amount of time, you can actually throw that patient into fluid and electrolyte imbalance and cause serious health concerns. It can actually happen. The elderly and young patients are particularly prone to problems from fluid and electrolyte imbalances. Okay, so we talked about what the fluid is, where the fluid is, how it can shift between the three compartments. We talked about how we gain fluid and how we lose fluid. But now let's talk about exactly how your body does it. So let's start with regulation of fluid gain. And always step back as you're learning these slides and look at the big picture. What's the big picture? Your body's really smart. It wants to be in homeostasis. So if you want to regulate how much fluid you gain, what do you want to regulate? You want to regulate the place where you get the most bang for your buck. You get the most fluid in you by drinking it. So what better place to regulate fluid gain than by regulating the thirst mechanism? Because that regulates how much you drink. So off to your left is maybe a complicated looking diagram at first, but I'm going to try to boil it down for you. So here we go. First, important thing to know, very important. The thirst center, this regulating center, is located in a very small but very important part of the brain called the hypothalamus, spelled here on your slides. That's where the thirst center is located. No better way to demonstrate how the body regulates fluid gain than by using an example. So let's use the example of dehydration. Dehydration means you lost a lot of body water. And how does that stimulate thirst? 3 ways it stimulates thirst. Number one, of course, you have a dry mouth. And sensory receptors in your mouth send a signal to the thirst center in the hypothalamus and say, my mouth is dry. I must be dehydrated. I will tell myself to take a drink. Okay, the second way that dehydration stimulates thirst is through something called increased blood osmolarity. Some of you are saying, that's a big word. I don't really remember what that is. But for this part of the course, please just think of blood osmolarity as blood saltiness. And what happens when we get dehydrated? Well, we're mostly losing water, more so than salts, out of our blood vessels. So as we lose that water, the saltiness of our blood increases. One way to think about that is, let's say you had a glass of water at home and you dissolved a bunch of salt in it and you let it sit out for a few days. What would happen? Well, the water would start to evaporate and you might even see salt crystals, right, start to layer out on the sides of the glass. And that's a good way to think about dehydration. As we get dehydrated, we lose water volume and the blood gets more salty. And once again, inside the magical, powerful hypothalamus, there are special receptors called osmoreceptors. Just think of them as salt receptors. Literally, they can kind of like, they can just kind of taste the blood. And they say, the blood tastes a little extra salty today. I must be dehydrated. So I will tell myself where the thirst center is located to take a drink. The third way that dehydration stimulates fluid gain is through decreased blood volume. Again, when we're dehydrated, we're losing blood volume, mostly losing water. If we lose blood volume, what happens next, circled in purple? We lose blood pressure. I mean, after all, if you have a hose and there's less water in the hose, there's less pressure in the hose. What happens next? The decreased blood pressure leads to a complicated series of events that we're really not ready to talk about yet because we haven't done kidney physiology yet. So what I want you to write down and or draw right here is kidneys shrivel. I mean, less volume, less pressure going to the kidneys, just kind of shrivel them up like a prune. And to make a long story short, when our kidneys shrivel up like a prune, they say, well, I must be dehydrated. I'm all shriveled up. So through a series of events, I will make some chemicals. I will send the chemicals to the thirst center in the hypothalamus, and I will then tell myself to take a drink. Those are the three ways that your body regulates fluid gain. I just wanted to show you, since we haven't gotten there yet, cross-section of the brain, beautiful medial view on a sagittal section, and the hypothalamus, very small but very powerful part of the brain, my favorite part of the body. You'll learn why as we go further on into the course. Okay, we talked about how the body regulates fluid gain. Now let's talk about how we regulate fluid loss. Fluid loss is regulated by several chemicals. These are all chemicals that we call hormones. This is just sort of the laundry list slide, so don't get nervous on this slide with all the big names. We'll talk about each one of those chemicals one at a time in that order. That's how I like to organize my slide. But what I want you to do is step back and look at the big picture one more time. We're talking about fluid loss. Your body's very smart. It wants to stay in homeostasis. If you want to regulate fluid loss, where do you think you want all these chemicals to work? Well, where do you lose the most fluid? You know, it's through the kidneys. We urinate it out. So guess where all these chemicals target? They all go to the kidneys. All these chemicals will regulate how much fluid we lose or don't lose by targeting and regulating the kidneys. So that is where the fluid will be lost by all these chemicals. So let's take a look one at a time in that order, starting with atrial natriuretic peptide. Uh-oh, that's a big word. On the weekends, when I'm out with my friends, people who want to be in my special group, we all just call it A and P. But let's break down the word, because there's a lot in a name in anatomy. So let's bust it down. Here we go. Peptide. Hopefully from AMP1, that's sounding kind of like a hormone, or kind of like a protein, because this chemical is a protein hormone. Atria. Hopefully that sounds like something in your heart you remember called the atria, because this protein is made by the atria of your heart. And what does it do? It causes you to urinate, and uretic sounds like urinate. It causes you to urinate out what? Na. And you remember Na is the chemical symbol for sodium. So this is a protein hormone made by the atria of the heart that makes you urinate out sodium. The name tells you everything. Another way I like to think of it is A-N-P, and I just put a P-double-E down here. I'm not immune to using third-grade bathroom humor if it helps us remember this stuff. And I do have a 7-year-old at home, so we can call this A-N-P. Let's talk about it. No better way to understand it than by example. So let's say we have an increase in blood volume. Like you fluid overloaded Mr. Jones a few slides ago. I hope you drew a picture making him look all puffed up like the Pillsbury Doughboy. And you've puffed up his heart as well. His heart's all pumped up and his atria are all stretched out. And the atria don't want to explode. So the atria make the chemical called ANP. And what does ANP do? AMP goes to the kidneys, and it tells the kidneys to let go of sodium. What goes with sodium almost always? Chloride. And what follows the salt? This is a key point. Water follows the salt. So AMP causes you to pee out salt water. Hopefully, therefore, blood volume and blood pressure will then decrease back to normal to get us in homeostasis. So if you want to pee out salt water, you want ANP. Let's talk about our next chemical called aldosterone. These slides you'll notice are set up the same way. They give you the name of the chemical, the location where it comes from, and then it talks about function. This chemical called aldosterone is made by the adrenal cortex. We haven't done that in the course yet, so I want to show you the special gland called the adrenal gland. I love that name because it reminds me it's added on top of the renal gland. In other words, it sits like a little cap or like a little hat right on top of each of our kidneys. And it's kind of a beautiful setup because, as we'll learn, the adrenal gland and the kidney, they're close together. They talk to one another. They communicate with one another. They can kind of sense each other. And that's really a nice way to think about this. So this chemical aldosterone is made by the cortex or the bark of the adrenal gland. Once again, no better way than to show by example. Aldosterone levels will increase in response to what? Low blood volume and low blood pressure. So, if the adrenal gland is sitting on top of the kidney and we have low blood volume and low blood pressure, the kidney will kind of shrink up a little bit. And that little adrenal gland hat sitting on top of it is going to say, hey, you feel a little bit smaller and shriveled up than normal. We must be low on volume. Maybe we're a quart low. So I'm going to help us out here. And what it's going to do, it's going to make the aldosterone. It's going to send it once again, to the kidneys, because that's where all these chemicals work, and it's going to tell the kidneys to hold on to salt. And what goes with the salt? Water. So this is the add salt water chemical. Aldosterone is the add salt water chemical. Aldosterone I think of as pump up the volume, because hopefully if we get the proper amount of aldosterone, the blood volume and the blood pressure will increase back to normal and get us into homeostasis. So notice, as you're studying, ANP and aldosterone, they're opposites. If you're in a situation where you want to pee out salt water, like if you're volume overloaded, you probably want ANP. If you're in a situation where you're low on volume, you want to pump up the volume. You want to add salt water. You want aldosterone. And that's a good way to think about it. Our third chemical that regulates fluid loss is antidiuretic hormone. Yes, all my friends on the weekend, we just call it ADH. And you need to know, of course, those abbreviations, they show up commonly. ADH, let's break down the name. Antidiuretic hormone. It's the don't urinate hormone. Other tips and tricks I have to remember this. I can think, or you can think of ADH as the anti-dehydration hormone, because it is the chemical you want when you are dehydrated. Another way I help myself remember this long term, I think of ADH as the add H2O hormone, or the add water hormone. To make a long story short, if your body wants water, you want ADH. Let's talk about it. First of all, where is it made? It's made in my favorite part of the human body called the hypothalamus. And that's kind of nice because ADH has an H in it and hypothalamus has an H in it. And I kind of connect the two and it helps me remember that long term for the test or whatever. And once again, no better way, I think, to learn this by giving an example. ADH levels will increase in the body when there is a decrease in blood volume or an increase in blood osmolarity. That's saltiness. What is that? You should know what that is. That's dehydration. Dehydration is low blood volume and high blood saltiness, just like we talked about a few slides ago. So, what does ADH do in a dehydration situation? ADH goes to the kidneys, like all of these do, and tells the kidneys to hold on to what with double stars? Hold on to water and water only. This is one of the rare places in this course that will ever talk about water moving by itself without salt. So ADH tells the kidneys to hold on to water. Don't pee out water. It's good to think of ADH as water. If you want water, you want ADH. If on the test your patient wants water, they want ADH. While you're making notes and maybe write some stuff down, I want to give you an example of this. You may say to yourself, well, okay, I can memorize these three things, but I'm never going to see these chemicals again in real life. Well, here's an example I'll tell you about, and this is just for you. There's a disease called diabetes insipidus. It's not diabetes mellitus. It's totally different. What this is... Well, usually you'll see it in your trauma victims. Bad head injuries from car accidents or balcony falls. And the people bruise their brain. Specifically, they bruise their hypothalamus. It's not uncommon. You'll probably all see it. If you bruise the hypothalamus, guess what the hypothalamus can't make so much anymore? It can't make ADH. If you can't make ADH, you can't hold on to your water. So what happens? Well, it comes out. How does it come out? You pee it out. And it comes out in buckets. Remember, a few slides back, I said, average human being, 2 quarts in a day, 2 quarts out a day. Well, if your patient's not making ADH, they can't hold their water, and they could put out up to about 20 liters a day. Imagine if you were the nurse in the ICU on that shift, and you had to measure the I's and the O's. You better do that one correctly, because if someone's losing maybe up to 1 quart an hour, it's only going to take a couple hours before they're on death's door if you're not replacing that fluid properly. So those patients will really emphasize the importance of fluid balance, and it'll be good exercise to take care of those patients, and you'll never forget it once you do. Okay, I have a few examples coming up on these next, I think, three or so slides. There's really no new information. It's really just a test of, do you understand all the stuff we just talked about? So I'm going to give three really good examples to try to put it all together. The charts look kind of complicated, but I'm going to boil it down to what you need to know for my course and for real life. So here's the example. It says here, your patient takes in a big load of salt. The example I usually give in class is, Mr. Jones is out on Saturday night. It's party night. He has high blood pressure, by the way, and he decides to skip all his high blood pressure medications, doesn't take any of his diuretic pills. And he says, oh, it's party night, so I'm going to go out and have a pepperoni pizza and wash it down with a six-pack of my favorite beverage and maybe some Pepsi or something like that. So what did Mr. Jones really do to himself? He ingested a huge load of salt. And that salt, you know, goes into his guts, gets absorbed into his plasma, into his blood vessels. And that's the key. He's jacked full of salt in his blood vessels. The osmolarity in his blood vessels is huge. So what happens? General principle, water follows the salt. Water is going to shift between those three compartments in Mr. Jones, and it's going to seek out the salt. So water is going to move from his intracellular space to his interstitial compartment and into his blood vessels where all the salt is. And he's going to pump up his pipes with a huge load of salt water. And what's going to happen? That it's like a huge sewer pipe now filled with salt water. And let's go off to the left here first. That big salt water load is going to be sent to the heart, and it's going to stretch the heart out. And remember, the atria doesn't want to pop, and it's going to make ANP. Remember, that's the chemical that causes us to pee out salt water. The other way I like to think of ANP, another memorization technique, is as the atria not pop chemical, because the atria does not want to pop. So in this case, ANP is going to be released. It's going to go to the kidneys. It's going to tell the kidneys to pee out salt, and water follows the salt. And hopefully we'll get ourselves back to homeostasis. So again, you want to pee out salt water, you want ANP, the atria not pop chemical. Let's go over to the right side of this diagram. Now we're delivering that huge pipe filled with salt water to the kidney. So over here, I want to simplify this because we haven't done renal physiology. I want you to draw a picture of a big inflated renal artery taking a huge saltwater load to the kidneys. Now, the kidneys, in this situation, are they going to be shriveled up like a prune? No. They're going to be all pumped up like a water balloon ready to burst. So remember our setup. We got that adrenal gland sitting on top of the kidney like a little hat. And in this case, the adrenal gland says, oh man, we're all pumped up and all swollen up like a water balloon. What should I do to help us out here? In this case, we don't want to add any more volume. We don't want to pump up the volume. We want to get rid of it. We don't want to add salt water. We want to release salt water. So in this case, the adrenal glands, they decrease release of aldosterone, which allows the kidneys to let go of salt into the urine. And what follows the salt? Water. And once again, we decrease our blood volume by letting go, by peeing out the salt water. We hopefully get ourselves back to homeostasis. I put a little question off to the side here, and it's really just for you, maybe while you're thinking about this and making notes. What if Mr. Jones is so fluid overloaded after his big party that the kidneys can't keep up with the load? Let's say the kidneys cannot pee out enough salt water volume. And you'll see these patients. They'll come in just like I described on Saturday morning. They skipped all their medications. They ate a bad diet. And they're all puffed up with edema everywhere. Well, if they can't keep up with the load, what happens is it backs up into the heart so much that the heart starts to fail. If you overload any organ, like the heart, which is a pump, the pump's going to fail. And they'll get something you learn called congestive heart failure, and the fluid backs up into their lungs. They have a hard time breathing. They start frothing at the mouth. They often get blood-tinged sputum coming out of their mouth. And once you see that patient, you'll never forget this either. Okay, let's do another example of body fluid regulation. Let's do the dehydration again. Remember, you got to know this. What is dehydration? Dehydration is decreased blood volume and increased blood saltiness. So what's the response of the body? Well, you want more water, right? So it's easy. You want to take a drink. So you want to increase thirst. Take a drink. This will dilute your plasma, it will add volume, and hopefully get you back to homeostasis. What about antidiuretic hormone? What about ADH? Remember, think of ADH as water. Don't mix yourself up here. It's the anti-dehydration hormone. It's the add water hormone. If you want water, you want ADH. So the proper answer here is increase in ADH. That reduces loss of water in your urine and hopefully again brings us back to homeostasis. Because if you're dehydrated, you certainly don't want to urinate out water. You'll see this in your dehydrated patients in the hospital. If you're measuring their I's and O's, they will put out very little urine because they're trying to hold on to everything they got if they're dehydrated. Thirdly on this slide, let's say someone loses a lot of volume, so much volume maybe that their blood pressure is dropping, their vital signs are dropping. If someone loses a massive amount of body fluid, then aldosterone might also kick in because at that point in time, if you're on death's door, you're going to take any kind of fluid volume you want. So you'll even take salt water at this point in time to try to get you back to homeostasis. So again, all these things are your body's response to try to return your blood volume and fluid balance back to normal. Notice on the slide, I'll give you a little tip, a little trick. for our course, you'll see any question I could ask you, any patient scenario, thirst and ADH will always go in the same direction. So it's easy. If you know someone needs to take a drink, you also know that they want more ADH. They always go in the same direction. I think I have one more example. Yeah, here it is. Let's give an example of water intoxication. In other words, is it possible for a person to drink themselves to death? And I'm talking about water here, of course. And the answer is yes. It happened, it was in the news, some kind of contest on the radio where they could win some prize. And some woman drank, I don't know how many gallons of plain water in how many minutes, but she ended up dying from water intoxication. So let's talk about it. What is water intoxication? That's where you're taking in too much water and not enough salts, not enough electrolytes. So in this situation, we have a decrease in blood saltiness, a decrease in blood osmolarity, because we're taking in plain water, let's say, without any electrolytes in it. And how does that potentially kill someone? Well, let's look off to the diagram to your right and try to simplify this here. If you take in a lot of plain water, that gets absorbed into your blood vessels. And again, which way is water going to move? Water is going to follow the salt, so to speak. So you have a high concentration of water in your blood vessels, and that's going to seek out the higher concentrations, which are inside your cells. So the water is going to move out of your blood vessels into the interstitial fluid and then eventually inside the cell. And that cell is going to swell. It's going to swell so much, especially inside your patient's brain, that it may lead to seizures, coma, and even death because your brain cells swell to the point they can get crushed or burst. So, what's the body's response to a water intoxication situation? How's the body going to try to correct this? Number one, please remember the all-powerful part of the brain, small but powerful, called the hypothalamus. There are salt receptors there. In this case, are the salt receptors stimulated? No. I mean, they're sitting there, you know, they're tasting the blood. They're saying, there's hardly any salt here at all. It's all just like plain water. I'm not very excited at all. So what will happen? There will be a decrease in thirst. Of course, you don't want to take a drink of water. You already drank too much water. We don't want to drink any more. And now I've made it easy on you. Which way does ADH go? It goes the same way, so you're going to automatically pencil in here, decrease in ADH. Why? ADH for our course is water. Do you want water in this situation? No, you already got too much. So if you don't want water, you don't want ADH. And how does that help? If you don't have ADH in you, you won't be able to hold on to your water. And your kidneys will let it go and you will urinate it out. And that, of course, is what we want to do in this situation. We have too much water in us. We want to pee it out. And then hopefully our osmolarity and fluid balance will return back to normal through these mechanisms. While you're writing down some of this stuff, maybe putting down some little examples and tips and tricks, I will show you or tell you where you will see this here locally. It'll happen mostly during the triathlon. My brother one year, he came down to visit and with a friend of his, and she was a professional triathlete. I mean, she had, you know, the helicopters and the teams stationed everywhere. And it was amazing to me that every step of the way they knew exactly what to give her as far as fluids, electrolytes, foods. She was so experienced. They had so much, you know, science going on in their team. They studied it so well. They knew exactly what she needed every step of the way to maintain proper fluid and electrolyte balance. But here's what happened. Some of the inexperienced triathletes, they're running or whatever, and they see the volunteers on the side of the road, and they know, of course, they have to drink. So a lot of times they grab those little cups of water, and what are they doing? They're sweating out and they're breathing out fluids. They're also losing electrolytes that way as well, but they're replacing it all too often with plain water. So even though they realize they need to drink to not get dehydrated, they don't realize that they also need the electrolytes as well. So they'll take in enough plain water to not be dehydrated, but they'll end up water intoxicated. And I've actually seen it. I've seen in the ambulances stationed at the triathlon in the back of the ambulance where they're getting treated with special saltwater solutions to try to correct their water intoxication. I think I saw more of that actually than dehydration. So yes, this is real, and you'll see it in Bay County. I want to introduce electrolytes at this point in time. Electrolytes, very important to understand in our body fluids. The diagram your book gives off to the left here is kind of weak in my opinion. Not a very great visual. And I just want to tell you a couple things to start here. Do not memorize the numbers on this chart. Until you use these numbers in the real world, they're just going to go in one ear and out the other. You won't remember them until you use them every day, so don't worry about that. What I do want you to know with respect to this chart is we live in a very narrow range. Just a couple of tenths off could mean the matter of life or death with some of these electrolytes. So when those lab slips come back and there's an abnormality, you got to bring that to the attention of the physician, because if we're just a little bit out of whack, that can mean a big deal to the patient. I mean, if potassium is too high, the heart could get a fatal rhythm. If it's too low, you could potentially stop breathing. So we live in a very small range. On this slide, we have the three major functions I want you to know about electrolytes. Number one function is, we already did it, controls osmosis of water between fluid compartments. And remember, one more time, water follows the salt. Second function we'll talk about in part two of this discussion. Electrolytes are very important in maintaining acid-base balance. And then finally, we'll talk about this in neurophysiology, and you already talked about it during muscle physiology. We can't carry electricity without electrolytes. That's right, electrical current in the body, electrical signals such as action potentials in muscles and nerve cells are carried by use of electrolytes. So they are critically important. Let's talk about the major cations in the body fluids. Yes, you have to know both the names and the chemical symbols. They appear both on charts in the real world and on the test. And one way I remember that the cations are positively charged is when I spell out cations, I make this big T a big plus sign. So just make yourself a big plus sign here, and you'll never forget the cations all have positive charges. We'll talk about the four major cations in the body in this order, starting with sodium. Notice each slide is set up the same way. These are kind of laundry list slides. I'll go through them efficiently because you can kind of read these at home. They're all set up the same way. The name and chemical symbol at the top. Then I list location. Then I discuss function. then we discuss control. Number one, sodium, you must know, is the most abundant extracellular cation. Functions, look what it says, and this will be a recurrent theme. Nerves don't work without it. Muscles don't work without it. And then point number two, we already know. Sodium regulates osmolarity of body fluids. So that's old news. Likewise, control. What controls sodium levels in our body, either directly or indirectly? We already did it. No need to spend time. Aldosterone, ANP, and ADH. Next, potassium ions, K+. It is the most abundant intracellular cation, if anybody asks you. That sounds like a test question, doesn't it? What about functions? Look here. Going to be a recurrent theme with the cations. Nerves don't work without it. Muscles don't work without it. I added one more function. Potassium with a P also helps regulate pH with a P in our body fluids. It turns out that potassium and acid will often exchange places in the body. What about control? It's our old friend aldosterone. I want you to know that aldosterone decreases potassium blood concentration by increasing potassium concentration in the urine. In other words, aldosterone causes us to urinate out potassium. The way I remember it is, okay, aldosterone, that was the pump up the volume. That was the add saltwater chemical. But for potassium, I just remember potassium is K+. I remember that aldosterone kicks out the K through the kidneys, and that's just my pea brain technique of memorizing that. Next comes magnesium. If anybody asks you where magnesium is found in the body, most of it is actually found as a solid in the bone matrix as magnesium salts, just like salt in a salt shaker is a solid. But this is the ion part of the course. So if anybody asks you where is magnesium found floating around as a charged particle in your body fluids, you will tell me they're mostly inside my cells. Functions. Here we go again. Guess what? Nerves don't work without it. Muscles don't work without it. And then I only added one more. Some of those chemical pathways you learned in AMP1, protein, carbohydrate, metabolism, those pathways couldn't take place without magnesium. So I just remember magnesium with an M helps with metabolism with an M. Lastly, on this slide, what controls magnesium in the body? Well, I'm keeping it really easy on you because I said the kidneys control it. Well, here's a big picture kind of a point. You could almost say that for anything. If anybody ever asked you what controls the level of this, that, or the other thing in the body, you could almost always say the kidneys and be right. Okay, while you're writing some of that down, I want to give you an example, and this is just for you, because some of you are thinking, wow, this is really getting nitty-gritty, and, you know, I'm never going to use this stuff, especially magnesium. Well, magnesium, again, is in our bones. Why is it there? It's there for strength. Magnesium gives extra strength and hardness to our bones. Those of you who are into cars and you get, you know, your new rims or your spinners or whatever you're getting, you know, those are alloy wheels. That means they're made up of a mixture of metals, and they often mix magnesium with aluminum to make them harder, to make them stronger. Those of you who rotate through the OB floors, you'll see magnesium used actually to save a woman and her baby's life. And here's how it goes. There's a disease called toxemia of pregnancy, or eclampsia. And in that disease, a woman develops seizures, and that could kill both the mother and the baby if it's not treated properly. And somebody who went beyond AMP2 learned that magnesium, one of the things it does to muscles is it relaxes them. So somebody who was very bright said, aha, maybe if I give magnesium in an IV to a patient, I can relax their muscles. And that's exactly what they do in these patients. They have seizures, and I forgot to mention, they also have very high blood pressure through the roof. So what they do is they administer what's called a magnesium sulfate drip. And the magnesium relaxes their skeletal muscles to stop their seizures, and magnesium relaxes the smooth muscle in the blood vessel walls to lower the blood pressure. Again, an example where this ion will save somebody's life. And you'll probably all hang that drip when you rotate through OBGYN. The last cation I want to talk about today is calcium. Once again, if anybody ever asks you where is most of the calcium in the human body, you say it's as a salt, as a mineral. And most of it is in your bones and your teeth as salts. You learn about calcium salts like calcium phosphate salts and AMP1. But this is the ion part of the course. So if anybody ever asks you where calcium ions are located floating around as charged particles in body fluids, you will tell me they are mostly extracellular. One way I have to remember that is, well, you know, I'm mostly made of cells, and if my cells were all filled with calcium, I would just be, you know, rock solid like a statue, and I wouldn't be able to move. And I understand that as you're studying these kind of laundry list slides, one of the hardest things to remember about the ions is their location. And don't worry, in the next part of this discussion, I have a special mnemonic where I really give you, I think, a pretty good way to remember which ions are intracellular and which ones are extracellular. So don't worry about that. I got you covered. What about functions? Here we go. Every cation, same thing. I kept it easy on you. Nerves don't work without it. Muscles don't work without it. And you already know it's in your bones and teeth. And from AMP1, please remember, you were not able to clot your blood without calcium. That was needed along the pathways you studied way back when. So blood clotting. And somebody who took AMP2 used that to their advantage. You're supposed to be taking this course not just to get an A. I want y'all to get an A. But you're supposed to be wanting to help people. So you might have noticed when people have their blood drawn in the test tubes and they sit on the nurse's station, that a lot of those tubes, the blood doesn't clot. If it did, the sample would be worthless and you'd have to draw it again. So someone who took AMP2 said, well, if calcium's needed to clot the blood, I know how to stop the blood from clotting. And in those special test tubes, somebody thought of a chemical and they put the chemical in there, and that chemical actually binds the calcium up so it can't be available. And the blood can't clot all by putting in some special juice to bind up the calcium ions. Okay, what about control? And I know you have this in AMP1. I've done that course before. I've seen all the instructor's notes. So this is review. Parathyroid hormone pumps up the calcium levels in your blood. Vitamin D also increases calcium levels in your blood. That's easy for me to remember because, well, you know, there's calcium in the milk, and if you ever look at the milk jug, it says vitamin D added. Why do they add the vitamin D? To help you absorb the calcium so you can get it into your blood. Other control is calcium. Calcitonin decreases blood calcium levels. I love the word calcitonin because it sounds like tone down. Calcitonin tones down the calcium levels in my blood. I think this will be the last slide for this part of this discussion, but while you're making notes, give you one more example of how important this is, and this is just for you. If someone's calcium levels are just a little bit low, since it affects muscle function, here's what can happen. They can start to go into seizures, really bad seizures called tetany. And those seizures can be so bad that if they're not treated properly, the patients can actually die. I usually hand out an article in class about this point in time. It's a real article where a three-month-old child was given oral laxatives. Why that was ever done, I'll never understand. But what happened to the child was they lost a lot of fluids and electrolytes, developed severe hypo or low calcium blood levels, so low that the baby went into tetany, severe seizures, and almost died. So yes, this is real life stuff.